Welcome to all you devoted and free thinkers and devotee conspiratologists. This will prove to be one of the most spirited first step interviews you will ever hear. But first I need to present you with an example of our conspiratology in contrast. Most of you out there in propaganda land are familiar with the Zionist-controlled ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, Fox News Network, and all the rest of them. Let's just take a moment to consider one of their paid mouthpieces. And just as an example, let's take Bill O'Reilly on his famous The O'Reilly Factor program. This notorious Gentile frontman, this Zionist stooge, draws an immense salary. He has his own global news reporting network program with unlimited expense accounts. He lives in luxury as a celebrity personality, and he demands prestige, power, and authority in the reporting field. He is always boasting how his programs are unbiased and his reporting is fair and balanced. But in reality, he is simply another run-of-the-mill, typical lying, deceitful, garden-variety, Jewish-controlled, yellow journalistic prostitutes. Like Geraldo Rivera. The only difference is Geraldo is simply another New York Jew, whose real name is Jerry Rivers. The controlled media has ensured that these types of paid lackeys are sincerely loved by almost all their listening population. Now for our outrageous contrast. I am Richard Masker and I am a conspiratologist. But today I will be interviewing an 82-year-old super master conspiratologist by the name of Eustace Mullins. That's Eustace Mullins. Please remember that name and look it up in Google or your favorite super search engine under Books by Eustace Mullins. You will be absolutely shocked by what you discover. Here are just some of the books that this man has written, and we're talking about very comprehensive, detailed books. The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, Secrets of the Federal Reserve, The Great Betrayal, and that's the conspiracy that undermined our Congress, The Rape of Justice, and that talks about how the conspirators have destroyed our court and judicial system. The Secret Holocaust, and this talks about how the Zionist International Communists have destroyed millions of innocent Christians. The New History of the Jews, the Rockefeller Trust, Murder by Injection, etc., etc. The list goes on. This man, Eustace Mullins, is a devoted and prolific political science researcher and a writer of the first magnitude, and he only tells the truth about the international Jews. He is one of the most hated men in America. He is savagely hated by our Bush-led coven of Jewish neo-Bolshevik Trotskyites and their Jewish-owned Federal Reserve banking system. He is despised by government puppet brainwashed law enforcement and the IRS battalions. The Jews and their secret media controllers hate this man without measure. And these are the same Orwellian double speakers that accuse him of being a hater, an anti-Semite, a neo-Nazi, a fascist, etc., etc. O'Reilly and Rivera are richly beloved Zionist propagandists, liars, and deceivers, whereas Eustace Mullins is a severely hated and slandered, reduced to poverty, and persecuted white American nationalist patriot who only wants to tell the truth. The title of our program today is Murder by Money. That's Murder by Money. And if there's one subject that Jews don't want you to know, it is how they destroy civilizations by controlling and manipulating those nations' economic mechanics. There is our contrast. And you heard it first here on First Step. Now on with our interview with the great American son, Eustace Mullins.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being with us today on First Step, your conspiratology program that does not deceive or lie, but tells the absolute truth, which you will not get on your Jewish Zionist-controlled networks. Today we are extremely fortunate to have a historian, a conspiratologist, and a prolific writer, Eustace Mullins. And Eustace, are you there?
Yes, I'm right here.
Wonderful. Glad to have you today. I'd like to have you introduce yourself and any contact information and any organizations or whatever that our people out there can contact you to buy your books or whatever.
Well, I've been I've been a student of the Money Question for 60 years, and I was introduced to it, of all places, in the insane asylum. My mentor, the poet Ezra Pound, was being held without trial and never did have a trial, and the government finally dropped all charges against him and walked out a free man. So you could say justice was served. But he asked me to go to the Library of Congress and look up the Federal Reserve System, which I had never heard of at that time. And I went to the Library of Congress, and I found some very interesting things there on it.
And about what year was this?
1948.
Whoa. Okay, go ahead.
So I started digging out this information and reporting back to Pound at St. Elizabeth's and Federal St. Elizabeth's Hospital, where he was held as a political prisoner. No charges were ever brought against him, and he was never tried.
Now this is Ezra Pound, the poet.
The poet, yes. He was living in Italy at the time of World War II, and so Alger Hiss, who was the personal presidential associate to Franklin D. Roosevelt,
yes,
suggested to Nicholas Biddle, the Attorney General, that Ezra Pound be indicted for giving aid and comfort to the enemy. The only aid and comfort he ever gave to the Italians was that he was living in Italy at the time. The aid and comfort he gave to was to the American people. He told the American people not to get into the World War II. It was a rerun of World War I by the same people for the same goals, and they should stay out of it. You see, Charles Lindbergh was telling the American people the same thing with his American Fair First Committee.
Okay.
So Ezra was in good company. But just as Charles Lindbergh was ostracized ever since for being a peacemaker, so Ezra Pound has been ostracized since 1939 because he advised the American people to stay out of a foolish war. If he had been alive today, he would probably have advised George Bush not to go into Iraq, which would have been very sensible since Iraq had never fired a shot against the United States, and its so-called dictator, Saddam Hussein, had been a paid associate of the CIA under George Bush for 34 years. So Saddam Hussein had earned his pension as a CIA asset, and instead we went to war against him.
Yes. Now let me ask you this. Did Ezra Pound at that time, did he understand the connection between the Zionist and the communist connection here for this war?
He did indeed, and in fact, he introduced me to it for the first time. I'd never heard any of this stuff. I'd never had any interest in it. But once I started, after the first day's research I did at the Library of Congress, I took the results over to the St. Asylum, and Ezra Pound said, "You've got to write this as a detective story."
Yes.
It's been a detective story ever since. I became a crime reporter, and that's all I've ever done.
Okay, well, we certainly appreciate what the contribution that you've given to this, because your books are wonderful.
They have a good following, I'll say that.
Yes, they do. I read your books back in 1982, and I was extremely moved by them.
Yeah, well, you know, none of my books have ever been reviewed or advertised anywhere. The New York Times Book Review doesn't know I exist.
Yeah.
And without advertising and without reviews, they've built their own market over 50 years, and they're still selling today.
Well, they're getting more prolific all the time. Your contributions were wonderful.
Well, this information is so important for every working American because he works and earns money, and he doesn't know what happens to it. He doesn't get it. It goes for taxes. It goes for depreciation of the money system, and it goes for a lot of things, but he doesn't see very much of it.
Well, I might add in passing that the title of today's program is Murder by Money. You wrote a very outstanding book exposing the American Medical Association, and in that book it was called Murder by Injection, and that's where I got the title for today's program.
Well, it's a good title. You know, when I came up with the title Murder by Injection, I thought it was a little too strong. This was 1988 when I wrote the book.
Yes.
Well, after I published the book, I never heard one objection to that title to this day. People seem to be very, very well satisfied with it.
Yes. Tell our audience where they can purchase or how they can contact to get your books, to find out about your books.
They can order them directly from me. I used to have a lot of distributors, but I had some illness a few years ago, and I had to cut back my business, and so I operate it from my residence at the present time. But the books are available for 126 Madison Place, Staunton, Virginia.
Staunton, Virginia.
Staunton, Virginia. That's an English name, S-T-A-U-N-T-O-N, and the English pronounce it Staunton, not Staunton.
Okay.
And so this is the birthplace, by the way, a coincidence, of Woodrow Wilson.
Oh, really?
His birthplace is about six blocks from where I'm talking from, here in Staunton, Virginia. And Woodrow Wilson, I told my audience for years, I said, a man who could give the American people the Federal Reserve System, the Federal Income Progressive Income Tax, and World War I and World War II, it can't be all bad.
Well, it's not a very good contribution for anybody, though, I'm afraid.
It's not a good contribution for anybody. And the odd thing about Woodrow Wilson is that at the age of 49, he had a complete nervous breakdown, and he went completely blind. So it seemed that he would never appear on a world scene. And somehow he came out of that and got himself elected president and signed the Federal Reserve Act into law in 1913.
Right. Right. That was the same year also that the Jewish B'nai B'rith brought in the Anti-Defamation League. It was 1913.
Yes, and 1913 was a good year because that was the year that the Rockefeller Foundation was chartered.
That was a good year for our enemies.
Oh, yeah. It was a good year for Satan.
Well, Eustace, we're here to talk today about it. Have you covered everything for your introduction that you want to cover?
I think I said Staunton, Virginia, 24401,
okay.
126 Madison Place, and you can inquire about my books at that address.
Okay.
Or you could call me at this number, 886-5580.
Do you have a website by any chance?
I had one, but it's shut down right now because we had some trouble with it, and I'm reorganizing at the present time.
Well, if the audience out there wants to contact you to purchase your books, I've already notified them in the pre-recorded introduction that they can go to Google or any high-quality search engine and look up Books by Eustace Mullins, and they're all listed there. And they can contact me here at conspiratology.com. I have an email at the top of our website. So you're in good shape there.
All right, that's
fine. Let's kick this program off today by talking about the mechanics of the Zionist control of money to despoil and devolve nations.
Oh, yes.
Now, I want to give you this as a quotation. The quote goes like this. Give me control of a nation's currency, and I care not who makes its laws. That was a quote by Amschel Bauer. That was Lord Rothschild, the first Jewish head of the banking system of Europe. And I'd have to ask you, Eustace, why and how have the Jews dominated the economic world of the Gentile nations?
Well, by printing their own money. You see, this is counterfeit currency. All the currencies of the world are printed by central banks. A central bank is a bank of issue, which which most people do not know. That means it has a license to print money. And when you print the money, you can print as much as you want. There's no restraint. And with the money that you print, you can buy anybody in the world. There's nobody who can resist whatever funds you want to give them.
Well, he said that he didn't care who makes the laws, because if you make the money, you buy the people who make the laws, right?
Well, you not only buy them, you put up the money for their campaigns and for their staffs and everything.
Yeah.
There's not a congressman in Washington who can go to work every morning unless the Federal Reserve System, the central bank, was paying his bills.
So that's the Federal Reserve System. That's the central bank that so many people were opposed to when it was established in 1913.
Well, they were opposed to it from the very founding of the United States. Thomas Jefferson was opposed to the first bank of the United States, which was a central bank set up by the Rothschilds after we won the American Revolution in 1787. And he opposed it, but George Washington, a Mason, signed it into law, and Thomas Jefferson was his Secretary of State. And when Thomas Jefferson became president, he refused to renew the charter of the first bank of the United States, which was the Rothschild Central Bank. And when he refused to renew their charter, this is something about history you'll not find in any history in the world. When he closed down the first bank of the United States, the Rothschild Central Bank, Great Britain declared war on the United States, and that was the only reason for the War of 1812. And you could go to any history book, and you won't find any reason for the War of 1812. And the reason was that Thomas Jefferson, as president, closed down the Rothschild Bank of the United States, and they had no central bank. And do you know that they had to go almost 100 years without a central bank before they finally got their central bank through Woodrow Wilson in 1913?
Well, I know it was a terrible scandal at that particular time, but yet the American people were so pacified and placated that they sat back on their laurels and allowed this 1913 Federal Reserve Act to pass right during Christmas break, Christmas vacation.
After all the opponents had gone home, all the opponents to the Federal Reserve System were Midwestern and Western congressmen. You say that they departed for their homes about the 15th of December. And that's when they rushed through the Federal Reserve System.
Well, let me ask you this question. As we look at the Rothschild and the banking industry, are there any other examples of this manner of unconventional warfare against countries? What other countries have the Jews controlled the money and brought the nations down?
Every country in the world has a central bank. And the central banks are all united, and they rule the world.
Okay.
The United Nations is a joke because the world is ruled by the central banks.
Well,
and the United Nations is a debating society, which John D. Rockefeller donated their headquarters in New York for the central bank governments of the world to meet and run things without the peoples of any country knowing what was going on, who was doing it to whom. And they're still doing it because they operate behind the curtain. And it's like being at a magician show, and you cannot see how the magician performs his sleight of hand. But the people in the know exactly what's going on, and nothing surprises them.
Well, it's amazing to me how the first line of unconventional warfare that they use is to get control of the money. And,
yes.
with the control of the money, then they can control the media, because by a certain period of time, they can buy up virtually all the media, and then they only tell the people what they want the people to know. And then people don't know about this magical sleight of hand that they're pulling off, and the next thing they know, that the whole money system is now under collapse. Would you agree with that?
I agree with it, and also it's counterfeit money, and the United States currency is being counterfeited by the en masse in many countries in the world, mostly in Colombia, South America, and in Pakistan. They're producing tons of U.S. Dollar bills, $50 and $100 bills, which are simply counterfeit money.
That's right.
And they got their plates from the Treasury Department in the United States of America. the same plates they use for the banking, the United States Printing Office on 14th Street. By the way, the printing office, which prints the money of the United States, is next door to the Holocaust Museum on 14th Street, right in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
Now, that is no coincidence.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, let me ask you this. On our money, it says it's a Federal Reserve note. In your definition, how would you define that under conspiratorial note?
Well, they don't say it's money. And in fact, it's so far from being money that the United States Congress finally had to pass a law making Federal Reserve notes legal tender. That means that until that law was passed, it wasn't legal tender. And they passed a law saying the Federal Reserve note is can be payment for any debt.
Well, most Americans listening to this program are going to have to come to the understanding of this sooner or later, so right now is about the best time I can think of to bring it to your attention. If you look at a Federal Reserve note, it says up in the upper left-hand corner, in little tiny print, it says, Federal Reserve note, this is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Now, that's a recent note. But if you look at a note that was several years back, 20 years back, it'll say, this note is legal tender for all debts public and private and is redeemable in lawful money at any U.S. Treasury or any Federal Reserve Bank. Now, you take one of these Federal Reserve notes, take a $5 bill, and you send it in to the Federal Reserve and says, Hey, buddy, I want to trade this back for lawful money. You will get a letter back from the U.S. Treasury that says very simply, please be advised that the term lawful money has never been defined in federal legislation. So we are turning your $5 note with a $5 Treasury bill. Now, what is your definition, Mr. Eustace Mullins, of what is lawful money? Because the government doesn't seem to know what lawful money is. That means that the money that we're using must be unlawful. It must be illegal.
Certainly it's illegal. And it's actually, I call it counterfeit money because it's being printed by the Bureau of Printing and Engraving on 14th Street in Washington, D.C., but it's on contract with a private bank, the Federal Reserve System. The United States government contracts with the private bank to print this so-called legal tender. And these the money which is printed by the Bureau of Printing and Engraving, and tourists can go in there and they watch this money being printed by the sheets, and they think that this is the government printing our money. And they don't know that the government has nothing to do with this money, and that, in fact, they have a contract with the Federal Reserve System to print it at so much a note.
Like how much a note?
Yes.
$3.50 a note or something like that?
It's under $2 a note. It depends on the volume, of course. When you print anything, the price, the more you print, the price goes down. And they've been printing money like crazy for the last 20 years.
Well, I think our listeners also need to know that if you look at the Constitution of the United States, the past United States, we're no longer the United States. If you look at the Constitution, it'll say, and I think it's in Section 2, Verse 2, it says, no thing shall be legal tender in any of the states except coins minted in gold and silver.
Well, Thomas Jefferson put that into the original Constitution for a very good reason. He did not want us to ever have paper money, because paper money is paper money.
Yeah.
And it is not gold and it's not silver. So Thomas Jefferson put that in the Constitution. And so when they passed the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, they got around that by saying Constitution, the Congress is delegating its power over money to a private bank. And Congress can delegate power if it so chooses for specific purposes. And so the Congress in 1913 delegated its power over gold and silver money for the United States They gave that power to the Federal Reserve System. They didn't charge them anything for it. The Federal Reserve System did not do this on a license, that they could pay the government so much for each bill they produced. But they sold these $100 bills at full face value to the United States. And they have never gotten $1 of Federal Reserve currency from the Federal Reserve System. United States government has never bought $1 at one penny off of discount of the full face value. So that's not a very friendly thing to do.
No, that's called...
We should get a 10% discount at least.
Okay.
We've never gotten one penny discount, and I'm the only person that's ever said that. I'm saying it on your program for the first time.
Wonderful. Eustace, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
All right, good.
Now, we're back with our interview with Eustace Mullins, who basically I consider an expert on money. And I'd like to ask him about what makes money money? What makes it of value? What gives money its true value? And what's happened to our money, Eustace?
Well, money itself is of no importance. You cannot eat a dollar bill, and you can't drink it. So money is a medium of exchange. If you want to sell me a car, and I have to pay you for it, I have to give you something in exchange. So my money is what you use, our negotiable instruments. They call it negotiable instruments. I can give you a check or a credit card for the car, but I don't really give you any money.
Okay. Now, what has made our money so valuable in the past?
The credit of the United States and the people of the United States is the only thing that makes money of any value whatsoever. Now, the Federal Reserve System simply swindled the American people out of its money and credit with the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 and did not give them one dime for it. It never has given them a dime for it. So this was one of the greatest swindles of all time, stealing all the money of all the people of the United States and using it for their own purposes. Now, it takes a criminal gang to do a thing like that, and this gang was led by one of the greatest monopolists in the world, John D. Rockefeller, of Standard Oil of New Jersey, which was the biggest corporation in the world at that time. And so John D. Rockefeller was the richest man in the world at that time in 1913, so you'd wonder, if he's the richest man in the world, why would he want to steal all the money and credit of the people of the United States? Well, the answer is, when you're stealing money, you want to steal more and more. You don't steal less.
That's right.
And so John D. Rockefeller actually set up the Federal Reserve System in a secret meeting at the Millionaires Club at Jekyll Island, Georgia, which is still there. And I've had dinner there, and I've had meetings there. And it was a private club until World War II, and then millionaire bankers decided to go elsewhere because it was kind of a dinky place. It's a little island off the coast of Georgia, and there's not much to it. It's sort of a sandbar. So they started going to Europe and places like that, and they didn't want to hang around in Georgia anymore, so they just walked off and left the place. So the state of Georgia took it over and made a public park out of it, and it's a rather nice little place.
That was where the founding fathers of criminality created the first Federal Reserve Act, right?
Yes, the Jekyll Island Club, at the time that they met there to write the Federal Reserve Act in secrecy and in criminal conspiracy, was the richest group in the world. At that time, in 1913, the members of this one small club were reputed to control 1/6 of the wealth of the entire world.
I think the leader of the pack, whose name was Warburg, wasn't it?
Paul Warburg.
Yes.
Was actually an employee of the Rothschild Bank.
And he was
his brother Max worked for the Rothschild Bank, and that's where they got their training in banking.
Okay, the Rothschilds were Jews, and the Warburgs were Jews.
They were all Jews. No Gentiles need apply, and so, in fact, the firm of Kuhn Loeb Company, which was the Rothschild Bank in New York City, it was never known as the Rothschild Bank because the Rothschilds claimed that they only had a very small operation in the United States, and that was the August Belmont Bank in New York. And August Belmont was rather a small operator, although he was a multimillionaire many times over. He practically invented racing in the United States because he had so much money that he raced horses and built racetracks and so forth. But the fact is that the Rothschild Bank actually commissioned the writing of the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 with Paul Warburg as practically its sole author, working for the Rothschilds. Baron Albert Rothschild of London put up the money for the whole meeting, and John D. Rockefeller was the sort of chairman of the whole operation.
Well, I've heard many people think and believe that the Rockefellers were Gentiles.
But but if you find a book by Stephen Birmingham called Our Crowd, in the preface of that book, he says that a distinguished Jewish historian had written that the Rockefellers were a Jewish family named Rockenfelter.
That's right. This is what I discovered later in years.
Oh, yes. It's the public knowledge. You can go to the bank. You can go to the library today and pick up a copy of Our Crowd, and on page 3 you'll see Birmingham's quote from this reputable Jewish historian that the Rockefellers were Rockenfelters, and they were always a Jewish family.
Well, let me ask you this. Now we've basically got deep, deep into the aspects of the mechanics of Jewish subversion of money in countries that they want to overthrow. And you know as well as I do that the Zionists have always looked upon America with trepidation. We are their enemies. We are the strangers that they have to control and keep under their thumb so that there's no uprising and pogroms and other anti-Semitic domination. Now, we've talked about the undermining of the money and what constitutes money. Basically, the Founding Fathers said that gold and silver can't be counterfeited. Therefore, it has a commercial wealth. It has to be mined. It has to be labored. It has to be molded. And it has to be worth something of intrinsic value to be a backing for our commodity of exchange, our money. Now we have no money. There's no gold and silver. Where is it at, Eustace? What happened to all the tons of gold and silver that we had stocked away in our mints?
Well, when the Federal Reserve as a central bank was created for the United States, they really no longer needed gold and silver because we went to all paper. The Federal Reserve note today, and during World War II in 1944, the Congress of the United States removed the last gold backing from the United States dollar. And the United States dollar since 1944, the only backing is paper bonds. You have paper bonds, which are interest-bearing currency. You may not know it, but you're paying 10% interest on the greenbacks that you carry in your wallet right now.
Well, what gets me is the fact that all of this treason, high treason against the American people, went on in subversive secrecy.
Absolutely. It was a criminal conspiracy at Jekyll Island. You see, President Theodore Roosevelt established the National Monetary Commission in 1907 in order to promote banking reform. And this National Monetary Commission was supposed to study the banking system of the United States and come up with recommendations for banking reform. Well, instead, they went to Europe and were wined and dined by the Rothschilds, and they came back here and secretly wrote the Federal Reserve Act. In other words, they completely subverted and betrayed what they were commissioned to do by President Theodore Roosevelt, although he was pretty much in on the scheme anyway. But
I see a pattern here. I see the same type of things happening then that we see happening right now.
Absolutely. It's the same pattern.
Americans go to the polls and they vote and they suck their thumbs and they say, all is well in the White House or in the government. And they don't seem to know what's happening. And this is why First Step, our program, is dedicated as a first step to understanding this. Now, give me an example of, or give me an idea of how the American people can sit back and do nothing while this enormous degree of high treason is conducted right in their government, right under their nose, month after month. How is it that the Jews and the Zionists can accomplish this enormous treason?
Well, it's not really treason, it's entertainment, because it's P.T. Barnum, the great show business master, who said, there's a sucker born every minute. And what you see is a carnival sideshow. Everything that takes place in Washington is a carnival sideshow and a charade, which is designed to mystify and puzzle the gullible, and they never have a clue as to what's really going on.
But we vote our administrators, our representatives in government, state and local, to represent us, to protect our families and our children and our country against this kind of stuff. What's going on?
Well, they betray us as soon as they get to Washington. There's an old saying in Washington that you can't buy a congressman because they're bought before they get there.
That's a new one. I've never heard that one before.
Oh, wow. That's an old one. Yeah. And a businessman told me that. He wanted to go to Washington and get some favorable treatment. And so he asked about buying one of the congressmen from Virginia. And so his associates told him, you can't buy Senator so-and-so. He was bought long before he got here.
Yeah.
And that's okay. What you're dealing with. You cannot go to Washington and buy any congressman today. They're already bought and paid for.
So basically the old concept of America, freedom and liberty, is of the people, by the people, and for the people.
And at the same time, the P.T. Barnums and the banking business have perpetrated the myth that America is a beacon light of freedom all over the world. And in fact, American soldiers today are going all around the world attacking small countries, which have never fired a shot against the United States, and they're beating them into submission. And all what they're trying to do is to introduce them to democracy. And democracy is essentially a country which has a central bank run by the Rothschilds, who get all the money, and all the people in that country are slaves of the Rothschilds.
Well, I think also I have to throw this in. When you said the word democracy, that really gets the hackles on my neck all stiffened up, because basically in America, the Jews are always promoting democracy, and the same way that they promoted communism and liberalism, and now they're promoting the New World Order.
Oh, yes.
Now, under democracy, it would seem to me that there's no representative for the people, and those who control the media, just like when Rockefeller says, give me control of the nation's currency, I care not who makes its laws, Rockefeller could just as well said, give me control of the communications media, and I care not who makes its laws, because as long as they control the money and the press, and NBC and ABC and all these other ones, then they tell the people. They incite the people. They plant into the minds of the people who they want the people to vote for. If some guy's running for president, they'll say, okay, stupid goy, here's five people, and they all belong to us. Vote for any one of them that you want. That's democracy in action.
It certainly is. It's supposed to be the will of the people, and it's not the will of the people at all. It's the will of the bankers.
That's right. That's right. All right, let's change gears here just a little bit, and I'm going to ask you a question that I hope that you can answer real well. I'm sure you can. Let's talk about one of the aspects of banking, which is called loan money, and it's called the curse of compound loan interest. Give us some background on that and where the Jewish bankers really made it with that one.
Well, they discovered in the Middle Ages when the Jews put their stocks of gold into the hands of bankers, and they deposited the money there, and then they found that it was very seldom ever withdrawn. So from that, you started issuing loans against deposits in banks, but not, you didn't actually get the money, but you got a loan, which signified that you had borrowed the money, and you were going to pay interest on it, and you would eventually pay that money back. So that was loan banking, and they cut it down even further when they got the Federal Reserve going. They got fractional reserve banking, in which you could lend that the amount of money that you had on deposit, you could lend it at 8 or 15 times the amount of money that which you actually had in your bank. You could lend out 8 or times money times the actual amount of money that you had, called fractional reserve. And so this essentially was creating money. Whenever you borrow $100,000 from a bank to buy a house, they do not lend you any money. They lend you credit. And so their money on deposit is not affected by this. But from the minute you borrow the $100,000 and you buy your house, you start paying back to the bank the money that you borrowed, the $100,000 plus interest. And that's what their income really is from. It's not from the money they have on deposit. It's from the loans that they create against the deposits that they have in the bank.
Same thing goes for your car.
Yeah, everything, it's all created money and created interest and created debt.
Well, I might interject something here that our listeners may find interesting, especially those new conspiratologist devotees. You have to ask yourself, what was the first money that was used in Europe? And surprisingly to most people, they don't realize that the first money that started this whole thing was cows. And in money, we talk about the pecuniary interest is money. Pecuniary is the old word for cows in Europe. And cows were very valuable because you could eat them, you could milk them, you could tan their hides, you could use their marrow in their bones to make candles. Cows had a tremendous amount of value, and this is what made them money, made them valuable. And a lot of the richest people in the communities were rich because they had a lot of cows. And these are called pecuniary interests. And this is where our money started, because gold and silver coins were valuable because they were hard to come by. Gold was very valuable and very scarce. Silver in the same token. So just as a passing interest, I would mention that to young people who are studying this whole thing about economics. Now let's get back to compound interest. Eustace, can you give us an idea of how compound interest can destroy a family or a country?
Well, compound interest multiplies at such a rate that the original loan can never be paid off. So you're, first of all, you're perpetually enslaved. Secondly, you can never pay off the debt. So it works out great for the bankers, and it's hell on anybody that happens to borrow the money.
Well, let me give you an example of something how that works that way, too, in regards to the Internal Revenue Service. You know as well as I do that the Internal Revenue Service, one of their minor aspects is collecting revenue. One of their major aspects is to harass and keep surveillance on patriotic Americans. It's not a major mystery how many people have committed suicide or died or destroyed themselves through alcoholism and
there have been a lot of heart attacks, but
yeah.
The IRS will not reveal how many taxpayers have died of heart attacks.
Yes, that's right.
That's top secret.
But the aspect of what I'm trying to get at here is that, I'll give you an example of me, for instance, and maybe you can throw some of this in here, of how compound interest can destroy you. When a person is on Social Security disability or just Social Security, and they have a history of being in activism, they're an activist, they're an awakened American white patriot. About 3 weeks after they go on Social Security, they will receive an innocent-looking little letter from the Internal Revenue Service that says, oh, by the way, we have discovered that in your tax return for 19-whatever, that you underpaid and you owe us $6,000 because of penalties and interests. So we're going to put a 15% levy on your Social Security disability check. Now, this is what happened to me, and it happened to my wife immediately after she started drawing Social Security. And they did an audit on her 1996 income tax, and she never even worked in 1996. She didn't make any money at all. But now she finds out that she owes the Internal Revenue Service $6,000, and the compound interest on that accumulates so rapidly that she will never be able to pay it off. And this is why they take it out of her check, 15% every Social Security payday, and she has to put up with it. And we've been trying to fight it and trying to fight it, and we still have a problem. We haven't been able to get them to do it. And this is how the Jews will get you into a situation where they say that you owe money, or even if you do owe money on not even money, we're talking about a credit. They will advance you credit, and you just continues to keep rising in cost, in compound interest, and all kinds of penalties, until there's no way in the world that you can pay it off. And you have to remember that they never loaned you money to begin with. They only advanced you credit, but you think it's loan money. Okay, I'm taking up all your time here, and I don't mean to do that, Eustace.
Well, no, I think it's very important that people hear this, because I've talked to so many people around the country who are getting pension checks from the Army and the Navy and so forth.
Yes.
And the IRS is taking their pension checks. They served in the war, and now the IRS says you haven't paid enough taxes. And this whole idea that you owe them money is arrived at through the very antique systems called, it was called the Spanish Inquisition, run by Torquemada in the Middle Ages in Europe.
Yeah.
And Torquemada himself was Jewish, and what they were trying to do was to collect money from the many Jews who are making a lot of money, and they didn't pay any income taxes. That was the whole idea of the Inquisition. It was not a religious thing, although the Catholic Church, they worked through the Catholic Church. It was not a religious thing, and it was not a question of ideology. All they were after was to ask you how much money you had, and you had to confess. You had to make a confession that you had a certain amount of money, and then they would tax you on that money. And that was the whole idea of the Spanish Inquisition.
So,
and what we've got today is the Spanish Inquisition right here in the United States. It's called the Internal Revenue Service, and it works exactly the way Torquemada set it up in the 15th century.
And it's called a 1040 form.
That's, yeah, the 1040 form,
yeah,
is the Spanish Inquisition.
Right. Okay, we're going to have to take time out for a quick break, and we'll be right back.
All right.
Okay, we're back with our interview with Eustace Mullins on money, the murder by money. And I'd like to ask Eustace, what do you think about the UCC, the Uniform Commercial Code, and how it's used today?
Well, it's become a masquerade. A lot of people think the UCC is a wonderful thing, and they try to file lawsuits under it and everything, and it becomes a complete farce because you can't do anything under UCC. Well, you can do some things, but you can't get very far with it. Everybody that I know that tried to recover debts and so forth from UCC never got a penny, because you have to get liens against people, and you have to get the county sheriff to handle it. And the county sheriff doesn't give a hoot who owes you money. He couldn't care less.
Well, what is the UCC, the Uniform Commercial Code?
Well, it was set up by business people to have some sort of standard under which they could do business with each other. That when they sold somebody goods, they could get paid for them. That's all it was about. It was intended purely as a necessary business tool to facilitate commerce. You could ship people goods and you would get paid for them. That was the whole idea. So they had to set up a commercial code by which these things could be handled.
Well, weren't those things covered in the Constitution and other financial, commercial, national policies?
Well, I think they were. I never really understood who originated the USCC or where it came from.
I see. But it must have its roots in history and antiquity.
Well, it goes way back. It goes back to the Middle Ages.
Yeah. The Jews were always the masters of commerce.
Oh, yes.
And so they were obviously the ones who put this thing together.
And it works for them, but it won't work for anybody else. If you sue somebody under the UCC, I'll guarantee you, you'll never see a dime.
Yeah. Well, the criminals, that's the enemies, are always the ones who are making the laws, and we are the suckers. We're paying.
Well, they make the laws for their own purposes. They don't make a law to help you. They make a law that'll make you more of a slave than you already are.
Okay, Eustace, here's a question for you, and I want you to listen to the question very carefully. Do the Jews claim title to you and everything you own?
Well, there have been rumors for years that the Federal Reserve System now has title to everything in the United States, and the people are so deeply in debt that the Federal Reserve System actually owns every piece of property in the United States.
Well, I've heard that the title of ownership is reflected by an individual's personal birth certificate, which is basically defined as a warehouse commodity receipt. You follow me?
Yeah, a lot of people repudiated their birth certificates for that very reason. They're trying to get out of this morass that they're in, but it doesn't seem to have much effect.
So it sounds to me like you're verifying the fact that the government does have a title certificate on hand with the U.S. Commerce Department that says that you and your children and everything that you own belongs to the Jewish controllers behind government. Is that right?
Oh, that's exactly right. And what they do is they give you the illusion of ownership. I mean, people believe that they own their house and they own their car. And in fact, when you get to court, you discover you don't own anything.
Well, I think individuals who are suckers and pay out the taxes to the 1040 forms, and they all of a sudden they can't pay it anymore, and something happens to their job or they get sick, and then they can't pay their taxes, and then all of a sudden there's a knock on the door, and it's the IRS, and they says, we have under this particular code number 6858403 or whatever, we have the power under the code to come in and confiscate all of your property. Now, that would indicate to me that you don't own your property. They own the property.
That's exactly right.
And they're there to clean up on you because you owe back taxes. Does that sound correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And, in fact, the IRS annually conducts auctions of businesses and homes that they've seized and confiscated. And so the people stand in front of their house and watch anybody coming by it and carry it away. There's nothing I can do about it.
Well, what gets me is the fact, and this is a fact, ladies and gentlemen, because I know I've been there, done that. If you don't pay your property taxes, which is the state gets authorization from the Internal Revenue Service, which gets it from the Federal Reserve System, if you don't pay your illegal, unlawful, and, you know, immoral and unethical property taxes, that they will take your home, even though it's paid for. Let's say that you don't owe anything on your home. You've spent your whole lifetime working to pay off your home, and it's worth, say, $250,000. The local county who has authority under state code will come in and grab up your house because you owe 3 years back taxes on your house, and they will sell your house on the front steps of the local county courthouse for whatever. And in the state of Idaho, and I don't know about your state, but they can keep the whole damn thing. They don't have to give you any money back.
Oh, that's exactly right. That's true everywhere.
So you,
all the sites are pretty identical in that.
So the people are standing there, and they're saying, what are we going to do? And the county commissioner says, we don't care what you do. In fact, we will buy you a poolside lounge chair, and you can take it down and set it up underneath the freeway overpass with you and your sick wife, and you can sit down there and rot for all we care. That's exactly what's happening in America, ladies and gentlemen.
It's happening to more and more American citizens.
That's right. So basically, you don't own the shoes that you wear, the underwear, the hat on your head. You don't own anything because they have title to everything, including your body and your labor that that body produces. And when you sign over a birth certificate to the federal government, it goes right straight to the Department of Commerce and the Treasury Department from the hospital where that child was born, and that child becomes the property of the state. And the state uses that child as collateral against a lifetime of labor to pay taxes for the existence, for just the privilege of existing as a human being under Jewish control on planet Earth. Now, if that isn't the ultimate nightmare, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know what is, and I've got an expert here that's saying, yes, that's true. Now, I got a real loaded question for you. Is the Constitution of the United States a true republic, or is a commercial, de facto, fictional, New World Order federal corporation? What say you, Eustace Mullins?
Well, the original Constitution was a genuine constitution. It's called the Articles of Confederation.
Right, right.
And under the Articles of Confederation, each state had absolute autonomy. That's why when the southern states seceded from the Union, they called it the Confederacy after the Articles of Confederation. But Abraham Lincoln said, we've got to preserve the Union. And so he invaded the South and destroyed the southern states and laid waste to southern states. And he said he preserved the Union. Well, the Union he preserved was a corporate state. It had nothing to do with the original Constitution of the United States. And this Constitution that was passed in 1787, the Masonic conspirators met secretly at Philadelphia in a closed building, and all of the delegates were picked and chosen by the Masonic Order. And most of the Grand Masters of the various states of the United States were right there in Philadelphia. They wrote this fake constitution. They got rid of, they were actually summoned there to rewrite the Articles of Confederation. And as soon as they got there, they said, we're not going to rewrite the Articles of Confederation. We're going to scrap it entirely. And we're going to come up with a constitution which sets up a corporate state, a corporate United States, and that's what we've had ever since 1787.
Well, our Constitution was disbanded and the new corporate republic was created, in my knowledge, in 1933 under the War Powers Act.
Well, yeah, that's true. In the bankruptcy, they declared that the original United States had gone bankrupt and was in bankruptcy, and therefore they, under the War Powers Act, and I've lectured with people that know all about that, and I've got all the information on it, and the War Powers Act and the Bankruptcy Act of 1933 sent this country into a whole new system of government.
And a whole new system of financial and economic control.
Yes, because in 1933 also, the Congress of the United States completely revised the Federal Reserve Act and so-called modernized it, and in 1934 the Federal Reserve Act was presented to you to the American people as a totally different organization.
I see. It's not very happy camper information, is it?
No, it's not very good, because when you talk about the Federal Reserve System today, you have got to go and read the revised Federal Reserve Act of 1934. And it is a total mystery to most people. In fact, I don't know that I've ever seen it. It's on file somewhere in Washington, but I don't think it's available to the general public.
Well, that's very interesting, because we keep quoting the Constitution. We keep the little packet in our breast pocket so we can...
Oh, yes, they have those things, 5 million of those things, and people read that, and they think that is a government instrument of the United States. But the fact is that the revised Federal Reserve System was put through Congress in 1934 by Governor Harry Byrd of the state of Virginia. And Governor Harry Byrd was simply a Rothschild employee who was, the Rothschild bought out the legislature of the state of Virginia, and they set up Harry Byrd as a total dictatorship. And it's, the state of Virginia has been a total dictatorship since that time. In fact, I have a $900 million lawsuit against the state of Virginia right today. Because they've been harassing me so much that I've had to fight back. And I've got this lawsuit filed against them.
You've got almost $1 million lawsuit against the state of Virginia because of what?
Well, you see, they were trying to kill me. And the reason they were trying to kill me was I had a couple of mild strokes back in 2002. And I was in and out of nursing homes for a while. But I recovered. And... So while I was in nursing homes, my driving license expired. It was good for 3 or 6 years. It expired. And in March 2003, and so I went down to the Department of Motor Vehicles to get it renewed. Now, renewing an expired license used to be automatic. But they refused to renew mine, and they wanted me to take a whole bunch of tests. And I took the tests, written tests and driving tests, and they said I failed them. And I was told by black women who were running the department that I had failed the test. And so for the last 3 years, I've had no driving license. And I have been repeatedly stopped and arrested and fined for having no driving license. And judges have given me court orders, a direct order from the court, that I must bring in a driving license. And when I go back to the DMV, they wouldn't give me a driving license. So then the judge would threaten to put me in jail for the rest of my life because I'd violated a court order.
Well, aren't you a terrible, nasty, white person?
Oh, I am indeed. And these black women who do the examination for the state of Virginia have orders never to give me a driver's license. So I finally got tired of this charade, and I went down and I filed a suit against them for $900
million. $900
million? Oh, yes, $900 million.
Whoa.
And
that's heavy stuff.
Oh, and when I collect that money, I'll be able to reprint some of my books that are out of print and various things like that.
Maybe you can even make a contribution to the International Conspiratological Association.
Oh, yes.
Well, I'll tell you, it's too bad you're not a mestizo that's come running over the border down in California, because then the government is just gushing to give you nice driver's licenses with your pictures and everything on it for free.
Well, they were coming to Virginia. And, in fact, the conspirators who allegedly wreaked 9/11 at the World Towers in New York City, every one of these alleged conspirators had a Virginia driver's license. Although I can't get one myself.
I see.
Of course, they had nothing to do with it. I don't know who these people were, but they were floating around. And, of course, none of them have ever been tried. They all supposedly were killed in the explosions, which is a good way out. You don't have to try any of them.
Excellent way out, yeah. Let me digress for just a minute, because I don't believe that we answered the question, and I think that our listeners would really like to know, whatever happened to those tons of gold and silver that we had in our vaults? Where's it at today?
Well, I had a friend named Edward Durrell, a businessman up in the Winchester area of Virginia. He had the Union Fork and Hoe Tool Company, which he wholly owned. It was a New York Stock Exchange firm. It made garden implements. It was in Columbus, Ohio. And so he made quite a few millions of dollars, and he got curious as to what happened to the gold in Fort Knox. And he spent several million dollars trying to investigate it, and they finally had a charade where they took some congressmen down in the elevator at Fort Knox, and they showed him an iron cage, and behind the iron cage were stacks of what looked like gold bars. And they said, see, there's all of our gold is right here. And the congressmen were not allowed to actually pick up or look at any of the gold bars. So they went back and said, all of our gold is safe at Fort Knox. And that's been the official government story ever since.
Yeah, and those are the politicians that are paid by the system to make that kind of a testimony, right?
Oh, yes. And the people believe them. They say, well, these congressmen actually saw the gold and told us about it, so now we know everything's okay. But Durrell found out that most of the gold in Fort Knox was secretly spirited out of Fort Knox, and that there is no gold in Fort Knox. And he thinks most of it was shipped to Switzerland.
Well, my understanding is that most of it is in vaults.
It's in vaults. Some in the vaults of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and
right.
Some in the Bank of England.
Right.
But I think most of it actually is in Switzerland.
Okay. How about South Africa?
Well, they're mining gold in South Africa, so they wouldn't be taking it there. They'd be getting more gold out of South Africa.
Yeah. Okay. Well, one thing for sure, it's not in our vaults in the United States where it's supposed to be as a backing for our money. That's what I'm trying to get at here.
Well, we can be pretty sure of that because the government assures us the gold is there, and whatever the government assures us about is usually a bald-faced lie.
That's right.
And so, in fact, we're in Iraq because of bald-faced lies. They decided Saddam Hussein, who was the CIA asset, was about to bomb the United States into nuclear waste. And he had no nuclear facilities at that time.
Well, you keep saying our government this and our government that. And, you know, sometimes I have a difficult time with that because is it really our government now? And so...
Well, it hasn't been our government for a long time. We have nothing to do with it.
Yeah. Okay.
We can vote for anybody we want to, but all of the candidates are carefully picked. A very select small group of people.
Okay, Eustace, we're going to have to stop right now. We have just unbelievably gone through our first hour.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And well, that is great news. That's the quickest hour I ever did.
Yeah, me too. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to end this program, but we're going to continue on with this outstanding subject of murder by money in our second program on First Step. And so I'm going to shut it down for right now, and I hope that you'll call your friends and everybody will listen to our next hour's program on Murder by Money with Eustace Mullins. So let's just stop right now, Eustace. Stand by.
Well, I think we've done a great job so far, and this will give us some time to recuperate and be ready for the next show.
Okay. Stand by.
Okay.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for tuning in, logging up to our program number 2 with Eustace Mullins on the murder of with money. We're talking on this program as a continuation of our last one-hour program that went so quickly. We're going to continue with money and some of the situations that money causes in our country and the dilemmas that we are in today. Eustace, I'd like to bring up something here that Americans don't seem to understand. They just don't seem to get the picture because the Jewish Zionist Communist New World Order controlled media doesn't seem to want to be generous with the truth. You are a man who's worked your entire lifetime presenting the truth, and you have been persecuted and hounded. But there's one subject that we need to get across to the American people, and that is, what is your interpretation of why we had the 9/11 bombings of the Twin Trade Towers? And we'll try to tie this in with money. What do you think?
We can do that very easily.
Go for it.
The money masters were getting a little nervous because we hadn't had a war for a while. And they have to have wars to keep the people occupied and to have enemies and to face death, you know, so that they don't have time to think about anything. And so they decided that they had, in order to keep the government in power, they had to have terrorism. And I have written an article some years ago called The Necessity of State Terrorism.
Uh-huh.
The fact is that the modern state cannot exist without terrorizing the people. Not its enemies, but its own people. You don't have to terrorize your enemies, because usually they're working with you anyway. But you do have to terrorize your own citizens. 9/11 was a bald-faced attempt to terrorize the American people. And it was advertised as that. They said, this changes the whole world forever. When two office buildings collapsed in New York City through demolition, the story about the airplanes burning them down to the ground is total nonsense, as the New York City Fire Department was the first to acknowledge that the whole story was a fantasy. And they've continued to do that ever since. And there's never been an investigation of 9/11, and no one has ever been arrested for it. But Larry Silverstein had bought the buildings a few weeks before they suddenly collapsed, and he got double indemnity, a double payment. He sued him for $3.5 million, and he got $7 million because he claimed that each building was hit by a separate airplane, and therefore they were separate incidents. And the insurance companies, incredibly, bought this rather naive supposition.
Sounds,
and paid him double money.
Sounds like Larry Silverstein's name sounds a little bit Jewish to me.
Well, it's quite Jewish. He was actually, he just represented some other people. He was kind of a small-time real estate operator in the New York area. And this guy from nowhere suddenly became the owner of the two biggest office buildings in the world.
Oh, just kind of overnight, kind of.
Overnight such a situation. And the fact is that Larry Silverstein barely had money enough to buy a hot dog, much less the two biggest office buildings in the world. So there was a little uneasiness about this mysterious figure who suddenly owned the World Towers. And then when they slid down and controlled demolition, because if you see any pictures of the, and I have people have sent me videotapes of it. The way those buildings came down was the same way that they've been blowing up buildings in Las Vegas for years.
Yeah. Control.
They sink from the top down. They sink very gracefully right down to the ground.
Yeah, it's called controlled demolition.
Well, I think there's a firm in New York that really did the job. It's called Demolition Corporation.
Well, I've heard that the Israeli Mossad was a big part of this whole program in the CIA.
Well, yes, that was all done, and it took a lot of planning. It took a lot of months before they were able to bring it off. And as no one's ever been questioned about that, and in fact, the Congress of the United States actually performed a very exhaustive 9/11 investigation, and they concluded they didn't find out one thing about it.
That was a big phony baloney routine.
Well, that was the greatest cover-up of all time.
Yeah.
But well, the people were satisfied because an investigation had been made, and they didn't find anything about it, so that meant nobody would ever know anything about it because there would never be another investigation.
Well, let me ask you this. You know farewell about the Pearl Harbor incident. The Pueblo.
Well, there were six investigations of Pearl Harbor during World War II, and they all came to exactly the same conclusion, that Kimmel and Short were the only persons who were responsible and that they failed to prepare for the Japanese invasion.
Well, that seems like Pearl Harbor was a incident that brought us into World War II with the Japanese.
Oh, yes.
And the
Hitler also.
And the Pueblo incident was the one that brought us into war with the North Koreans.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, and we have the blowing up of the Maine, and we have all kinds of these little, you know, the bombing of the Lusitania, and there's all kinds of little things on the end of the stick that the Marxist Zionists use to tickle with the Americans' mentality to get them conducive to fighting these foreign wars. Now, what about 9/11? Was that another Pearl Harbor?
It was greeted as a Pearl Harbor at the very time. The press covered the 9/11 incident, and they said this is another Pearl Harbor, and apparently it was.
Well, I'm going to bring up something here that's not very nice, and I would like to have your projection on this, your conspiratological reasoning. And I want to acknowledge to our people that you are a supermaster conspiratologist. Your works have proven that over the history.
Well, my books have been circulating all over the world for 50 years, and not one word has ever been challenged or denied by anybody in those books.
That's right.
And you can bet that they've been gone over with a fine-tooth comb.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
No one has ever contacted me anyway and said, you said on page 32, you say so-and-so, and I find that that's not true. But I've never received such a communication, and I probably never will.
Well, I'll tell you, I really am surprised about one thing, though, about your books, and that is that you don't seem to have written a book on the Jewish Holocaust.
No, I did write an article called The Holocaust Explained for Jim Warner of the CDL Report some years ago.
Okay.
And I've still got copies of that. But really, I haven't read much about the Holocaust because there really isn't much to write about it.
Since it didn't really exist the way it's been portrayed to exist, right?
Well, the strange thing is that the Jewish people apparently had such self-hatred that two Jewish bankers hired, they were Max Warburg and Max Oppenheimer, two of the richest Jewish bankers, hired Adolf Hitler to exterminate the Jewish people. That's the story they were told. But why these two Jews wanted to exterminate the Jewish people, no one's ever really explained that. And I have no explanation for it myself.
Yeah. Well, we had a two-hour program on First Step with Mark Weber of the Institute for Historical Review.
Well, I know Mark.
And he went into that in great detail.
Oh, he did go into that. I'm glad he did.
Oh, yeah.
Because as far as I know, in recent years, I'm the only person that's been telling people right and left that there were two Jewish bankers that financed Nazism. You know, they put out the fake story in this country for many years that German industrialists financed Adolf Hitler.
Yes.
And German industrialists wouldn't touch him with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah.
And the only people he could get to finance him were Jewish bankers.
Well, to get on back on track and talk about finances and commerce, what did 9/11 do in regards to promoting Jewish commerce? You know, we spent untold billions of dollars in bombing this innocent little country of Iraq back into the Stone Age. Didn't that have some implications financially for the American taxpayer?
Well, certainly they had to pay for those bombs. Well, you know, they bombed Yugoslavia into submission also.
That's right.
And you say Yugoslavia was part of Adolf Hitler's war plan to bomb Yugoslavia into submission. And he failed to do it because he invaded Russia at the same time, and he didn't have the forces to do it. So we had to go for many years until President Bill Clinton came along and carried out the Adolf Hitler program of bombing Yugoslavia.
Well, we also had a problem with the Serbian and Kosovo because these guys were starting to cause a lot of stink, and they didn't want to really go along in Cowtown to General Clark's New World Order under NATO. And so we had to bomb them back into the Stone Age, too.
Oh, yes. Well, this is a whole chain of events that taken place of bombing these little countries into the Stone Age. And it all apparently was a part of the original Nazi program.
Well, I heard yesterday on the news, the Zionist control news, that the president now wants to pass a budget because he's got to get more and more money for his war aims at all the little countries that surround the city or the nation of Israel. And so consequently, right now we find from his proposals that the American taxpayers are paying $3.1 billion, that's billion with a B, $3.1 billion a month for the war that we're carrying out to safeguard Israel in the line of protection against his Arab states.
Oh, yes.
Now, what do you say about that, Eustace?
Well, you know, just before he invaded Iraq, President George Bush said, our mission is to defend Israel.
Yes.
Well, the interesting thing was that nobody was attacking Israel. But we went to war anyway.
Well, I think most Americans don't realize that Israel is the only nuclear power in the Middle East.
It is indeed. And it's got more nuclear weapons than all the other Middle East put together. They haven't got any, as far as I know.
Well, the reason I'm bringing this up, and we're supposed to be talking about money, and I hope that the American people realize that we are on track, because we're talking about the little bandit parasite state of Israel. Excuse me, Christians, but that's a fact. This little group of international psychopathic killers and pathological liars called Israel is the control of money on the world scale, and they've got to be protected by their own stooge politicians in Washington at all costs. And they could care less about you and the welfare of your family, your children, your education, and whatever. This is the most important thing, and this all comes back to money and world Jewish power.
It certainly does. And, you know, I have a book called The New History of the Jews, which
yes.
was published in 1948, and it's out of print right now, but I'm going to reprint it. And it's considered by many people, many of my readers, the most important book I ever wrote. And in that book, I reveal the origin of the word, not the word Jew, but the word Hebrew.
Yes, Hebraia.
It's Habiru.
That's right.
And it means cutthroats and bandits.
That's right.
They were known all over the Middle East as cutthroats and bandits, and they still are.
Well, I think, just to throw this in here, 600 B.C., Hammurabi called them the bandits, the Hebraia, and the highwaymen on the commercial highways on the Tigris-Euphrates rivers. And then along came Nebuchadnezzar, 458 B.C., and he went down and sacked Israel, and he called them the same thing. They were highway bandits, the stranger. They were the Hebraia. And so the Jews have thousands of years of history of being the parasites and the controllers of society. This is nothing new, and I just don't understand how especially our religious community can be so devout in worshiping these creatures as God's chosen people.
Well, they respect the contract because, you know, God gave Abraham his contract, which they signed, of course, and says that they should have the whole world.
Well, they're certainly working.
So we have to live with that contract.
That's called the New World Order today, right?
It is indeed.
Let me ask you this question. As we're talking about the New World Order, you answered this for me way back when I was on radio, and I had you on as my special guest on my radio program. I want to ask you flat out, Eustace Mullins, what is the most secret society in the world today?
The most secret? Well, in my book, The Curse of Canaan, I trace secret societies, and there are the Freemasons, and there are the Illuminati, and there are the Hebrews, and so forth. They've got secret societies all over the world, but it boils down really to just one secret society. And they are all over the world, and they work together.
Well, is that one secret society called the World Jewish Congress?
Oh, yes.
That's what
it was originally called the World Zionist Organization, And in 1923, there was an upcoming young politician in Europe called Adolf Hitler. And in 1923, he merged his Nazi group, which started with seven people, and he merged it in 1923 with the World Zionist Organization. And World War II and the so-called Nazi horrors that were inflicted on the world came about through the World Zionist Organization. And, you know, the so-called concentration camps at which all the Jews in the world supposed to were exterminated was run by the Sonderkommandos. It was a Jewish corps. So-called Nazi concentration camps were run by the Sonderkommandos, which is the Jewish corps. So all of the alleged Holocaust and extermination of Jews were carried out by Jews themselves.
I understand that these were trained Jews in the Soviet Union, and they were basically the entire Holocaust was fabricated to be used as a propaganda tool in future years after the war.
Well, they didn't even start the Holocaust propaganda after the war. Now, I recall very well, it was about 1965 before they really started promoting the Holocaust myth.
Yeah, yeah.
Although the war ended in 1945, so all the Jews were dead and so forth, but it took 20 years for the Jews to find out that they'd been exterminated.
That's a pretty good trick, I'd say.
Yes.
Listen, we're going to take a quick break here.
All right.
And we'll be right back with Eustace Mullins. Stand by. Okay, we're back with our program called Murder by Money with our special guest today, Eustace Mullins. I sincerely hope that our listeners will contact their search engines and look up his books. And they're just as valid right now as we speak as they were the moment they were printed several years ago.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing. My books don't date at all. And I've never printed an edition of my books that didn't sell out. I never had to advertise them or promote them at all. People read the books, and I told people about them, and they got other people to order them. That's the only way that I ever sold a book in my life.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know as I've been around the country and I've talked to various people in giving my lectures on conspiratology, there have been so many people that have approached me and said, "My gosh, Mr. Masker, I'd never realized what was going on until I was handed a book by Eustace Mullins called The Federal Reserve Conspiracy." So you have been very, very active and very prolific in getting the
and
word
actually,
out.
I would never have heard of the Federal Reserve System if I hadn't gone to visit Ezra Pound in the insane asylum.
Yeah, yeah.
So the government really did a great boon to me by locking up Ezra Pound in St. Elizabeth's, because I would never have met him otherwise. He would have been in Europe, and I had no way to go to Europe, and I never have been to Europe to this day. So I would never have found out any of this.
Well, he opened up a whole area of investigation for you that I'm sure this is what this program, First Step, is trying to accomplish, and that is bringing the knowledge of the New World Order conspiracy, the Jewish Zionist conspiracy, to our young people. So we just want to say thank you so much. You're a very outstanding American, and we appreciate your work.
Well, I appreciate your thanks, but it all was handed to me.
Yeah, well, it wasn't handed to you. I know that for a fact. You've done
a lot. It wasn't handed to me. I had to go after it. But, in fact, Ezra Pound was imprisoned for life without trial, and he was only a mile from the Library of Congress, but they absolutely, he would never have set foot in the walls of the Library of Congress, because they were going to keep him there in that same asylum for the rest of his life. But I came along, and he asked me if I would go down there and look it up. And I was mystified by it, because I didn't have any idea what he's talking about. But when I went in there and opened up the whole world to me, I found books stacked in the Library of Congress, stacked up on the floor, gathering dust, with the covers coming off and everything else. That place was in chaos. but I went through every inch of it. And, you know, I finally moved into the Library of Congress.
Oh, really?
I lived there for a while.
Really? That was your address, huh?
Well, it was my address. I was right there and on Pennsylvania Avenue. And the reason I moved in for it to it was because I had been fired from the staff of the Library of Congress. And, of course, I don't no longer had any income. And I was living on a dollar a day in Washington at that time, but I didn't need a dollar a day anymore. So I moved into the library. And just I went in there at 9 o'clock in the morning, and at 9 o'clock at night I found this dressing room that I could sleep in on the ground floor, and I just went back there and went to sleep. And then I got up the next morning and went back to work on my research.
Oh, that's unreal. Unreal. At this particular point in time, I'd like to bring up to our listeners the fact of that came out in one of our last episode of First Step. That was when we were doing research on South Africa. And I just want to renew to the memories of our people that the South Africans were the original Dutch people that set up South Africa. And there was virtually hundreds of thousands of them that came in and developed and discovered the diamond fields and the gold mines in South Africa. And then when the Jews in around the world, especially in London, discovered this enormous wealth buried, that they brought in organizations like the World Jewish Congress organized the ANC, the African National Congress. And the Jews, communists, were enabled to organize blacks to flood down to South Africa to be used as labor to open up these gold fields and gold mines and silver and the diamond mines. And after a while, they got the blacks and the government to control the South Africans to the point that they could come in and confiscate and take over those diamond mines. And now De Beers is a Jewish-owned company that has a monopoly on the South African diamonds.
Oh, yes. And it's the Oppenheimer family actually owns it.
That's right.
De Beers is just a trade name.
Right. But the point I'm trying to make is that money has always been one of the primary elements in the Jewish arsenal for destroying countries. And when they find wealth, they will destroy anybody. They even had the British soldiers go down and kill their own racial brothers and sisters. And they're doing it right now. Because
yes, indeed. And the term concentration camps came into being for the first time in 1898 during the Boer War, when the British started locking up the Dutch farmers and their wives and children in these concentration camps under horrible conditions.
Right.
So they gave concentration camps to the world, which is not generally known.
Well, I would ask our listeners to go and listen to our program on South Africa. It's right here on the agenda on the First Step programs that you'll enjoy. Now, you know, Eustace, we've talked some terrible, terrible things here about the American economy. What does the future hold, in your opinion, for our white American civilization if we continue to do nothing?
Well, we're not going to continue to do nothing because people are finding out. And there's one thing going on right now on the Internet, which is putting out tons of information, vital information, every day, and it's going out to a lot of people, and it's just creating a whole new current of excitement in this country, which I've never experienced in my life.
So, what do you... You know, I'm getting, on the Internet, especially, I'm getting some pretty dismal reports that we're looking at a financial collapse.
Well, we probably are, but after all, you can't build a sound economy on counterfeit money.
That's right.
So it probably will collapse at some point, but when it does, we'll rebuild. And then we'll build a sound economy.
And they have control of the Congress, and they have our control of our state representatives. They have control of our county commissioners, basically through these state statutes and state constitutions.
Well, all that was set up by John D. Rockefeller with his Standard Oil money. But it got so bad they had to run them out of Chicago, and they're now, the Council of State Governments is now located in Lexington, Kentucky. and they've been there for quite a few years, but they're running this whole operation with their counterfeit money. And when we get real money in this country, that whole operation is going to collapse of its own volition.
Well, here again I go. I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but I'm going to have to say, what should every single American be doing to take America back from the Zionists?
Well, they've got to educate themselves, first of all. They've got to find out the facts.
That's right. That's right. Good.
And they cannot move without knowing what they're doing.
Then what?
Then we'll start taking the country back.
How?
Well, it can be done by voting, or it can be done by taking back the monetary system. It's just simple steps, but there are things that have to be done. And that's not going to be easy at first. There's going to be some bloodshed at first, but I don't think it's going to last that long. Because the American people are still sound. I have traveled all over this country for many years, and everywhere I've gone, I have seen that the American people are still sound, and they're still the same people that we always had.
Even in light of the Zionist-controlled media filth and propaganda and degenerate conditioning for our people, you still have faith in the American people?
Oh, yes, I have faith in the American people as themselves, because the media propaganda and the television and the radio and all that and the Hollywood movies and so forth do not actually permanently change the thought, thinking process of the American people. It's a temporary situation.
Temporary.
And that television screen can go blank right now and never show anything again, and the whole thing will turn around.
Well, I hope, I wish I had your optimism. I'm looking here personally at, from my years of study, we're looking at a bloody revolution.
Well, that's possible, but it could be a very short-lived revolution.
Yeah.
Because these people have a history. When things get hot, they run. They don't stand and fight.
Yeah.
And it could be in 3 days, it could all be over.
Well, one of the things also that I'm concerned about is that I have had a lot of conversations with top medical people, and the Jews are not going to stand by and let a pogrom take them over. They're going to use every scientific and technological opportunity they have to decimate our numbers.
Well, they certainly are. Well, they're doing it right now.
Well, I think this bird flu hocus-pocus is part
of that. That is typical. Now, no one has ever heard one word about George Bush appropriated $7 billion to fight the bird flu, but we've never had a single case of bird flu.
Yeah.
No one knows who's got the $7 billion.
But he's doing all of this to be benevolent and humanitarian, because he's concerned about the welfare of the American people. Don't you understand that, Eustace?
Well, I understand that President Gerald Ford launched a crusade to stop the swine flu, which didn't exist at that time.
Yeah.
And he lost his reelection to Jimmy Carter.
That's
which
about,
was a real disaster for the country, but it wasn't swine flu. It was Carter flu.
Yeah, that's about as ridiculous as going after the green monkeys for causing the AIDS epidemic, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So,
well, they seem to think that if you gear their fantasies to four-year-old minds, that it'll go over. And I guess it usually does work for temporarily.
Yeah. Well, let's just visualize to ourselves that listening to this program right now is a husband who's working himself to death at a typical job, and he's got a wife and two or three children, and they're looking at you and they're saying, Eustace, what do we need to do to prepare for what's coming down the pike very quickly? What would you say to them?
Well, you have to have the facts. You can't do a thing without the facts. And what I've talked to you all about this program tonight, if I said this at most towns in this country, I would be taken right to the lunatic asylum, just like they did Ezra Pound.
Yeah. Well, what do you think that family should be doing right now to prepare for what's coming?
Well, they got to start preparing right now. They got to find out everything about what's going on. They got to find out the facts behind everything that's going on in Washington and in the United Nations, which was set up by Alger Hiss, the greatest traitor in the history of America. and John D. Rockefeller, and who was just working for the Rothschilds all his life. You know, John D. Rockefeller was a $10 a week accounting clerk in Cleveland when he became the richest man in the world. Well, all he did was go to the National City Bank, a Rothschild bank, the National City Bank of Cleveland, and that is the same City Bank which is doing business on Wall Street today as Citibank. And they put up the money for him to build the greatest monopoly in the world. He didn't just get a monopoly of oil. He got a monopoly of oil refining.
Yeah.
That's gasoline.
Yeah.
And that's where the money really is. The money is not in oil, because H.L. Hunt told me one time that he was the richest man in the world at that time. And he told me, he said, I don't have a brand. I don't have anything to sell. He could pump the oil out of the ground and sell it to the Rockefellers, but he couldn't do a damn thing with it himself.
Yeah. Well, tell me, what is your opinion of the phony Colonel Mandel House?
Oh, Mandel House, his father, was a very important guy during the Civil War. You see, the British were dependent on Southern cotton for their Manchester textile factories in England.
Uh-huh.
And their prosperity depended on, they were manufacturing cloth for the whole world. And when Abe Lincoln cut off the importation of cotton, somebody had to get some cotton to England somehow. And so the Rothschilds sent a man over named Colonel House's father. And he sort of became the master of bootlegging cotton out of the South and over to England, and kept England going during the Civil War. And when the Civil War was over, his son, Edward Mandel House, was the only person in the South that had any money. He had been paid gold for all the cotton that he shipped to England, so he was the only person in the South that had any gold. So he took over the politics of the Southern states, and he finally elected Woodrow Wilson as president, and so he was the most important person in the world. In fact, there's a house two blocks from where I live where he directed his operations for a while after the Civil War. The whole South was ruled by one little cottage up here, about two blocks from where I'm talking.
Well, Mandel House presented to Franklin Delano Roosevelt the New Deal.
Oh, yes.
What can you tell us about the New Deal?
Well, see, Edward Mandel House's first big protege was Woodrow Wilson.
Yes.
And Woodrow Wilson himself had a protege named Franklin D. Roosevelt, who became his assistant secretary of war during World War One.
And also, I think you will probably confirm this, that surrounding these traitors were a whole pack of Jewish consultants and Supreme Court justices and so forth.
Oh, yes. Sir William Wiseman, who was a partner of Kuhn Loeb Company, actually ran the United States and British governments. He, out of England, he was in London, and he ran the British government, and he and Edward House ran both the British and American governments through the First World War.
Frankfurter?
Frankfurter came later. He was with Roosevelt.
That's what I'm talking about now. He's also Brandeis.
Oh, yeah, Brandeis. Well, Brandeis was put on the Supreme Court by Woodrow Wilson at Edward Mandel House's suggestion.
Yeah.
And he was, and Brandeis was actually the president of the World Zionist Organization.
Right.
He was the world's most important Zionist, and here he was the head of the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
So this is the way they operate. They put their people in, and they do what they're told to do.
Okay, what can you say about the New Deal?
About who?
The New Deal.
Oh, the New Deal was a farce at the very beginning. It was actually modeled after fascist Italy, the corporate state, in which all corporations became state agencies.
Well, I know at that particular time, Roosevelt came out and he said he had read The New Deal by Mandel House. He says, oh, this is the greatest thing I've ever heard. This is what we got to do to save our republic, blah, 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 blah. And that's just what they used to start the corporatization of America, especially during the 1933 War Powers Act.
Well, actually, it wasn't so much a corporatization of America, but they set up a government bureaucracy which became which ran everything in this country.
Yeah, under a corporate type of rule.
Oh, yeah, it was all corporations.
That's right. Well, we're going to take time out for a quick break, and then we're going to come back and finish up this really wonderful interview with Eustace Mullins, and we're going to be talking about what you as an American can do to prepare yourself to take your country back. Stand by. Okay, we're back with our interview with Eustace Mullins on the murder by money. We've done really good, and we're coming down to the last part of our two-hour program, and this is a program number two in this interview. I've still got to get back to the family that's sitting there talking to you about, and they're desperately wanting to know, Eustace, what we need to do right now? Are you a gold bug? Should we put money in gold and silver? Should we buy some guns and ammunition and food supply and fresh water storage? And what are we going to do?
Well, you know, Lenny Levitt, who is a Jewish commentator out of Toronto, he has the Cloak and Dagger show, and he interviewed me when I was up in Ohio about a month ago. And he came out of the blue and asked me to outline the economy of the next 4 years. And so just off the top of my head, I had to tell him everything was going to take place in the next 4 years. And I don't have a tape of that talk, unfortunately. They did make a tape of it, but I didn't get it before I left there. So I was fairly upbeat, but not wildly optimistic. I was just upbeat over the whole thing. I thought, to me, the tide was turning. They'd gone about as far as they could go. I think the Iraq War finished the state of Israel because Israel's dream of conquering all of the Middle Eastern states, the Arab states, and taking over the oil supplies of the world, which, of course, would finance all of their future operations. But they were supposed to knock off Iraq and then Syria and Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Right.
And Boy George bogged down in Iraq because his own father told him, you cannot go into Iraq, you can't win that war. And the Jews, the neocons, assured Boy George that he could do it. So he went in there and he bogged down and been stuck there ever since. He's going nowhere. Because Iraq itself is composed of three groups, the Sunni Muslims and the Kurds and another, the Shiite Muslims. And they're early conceivable because Iraq was created by Woodrow Wilson and the Jews at the Versailles Peace Conference in 1919. And it was never intended to be a viable state, and it never has been. And the only way that you could make Iraq a viable state would be to reconstitute it with these three warring elements moved somewhere else.
Yeah, right.
So there's no way out.
Well, I'm trying to get you to say which way you believe on this. Do you believe that the American people, as a family-centered group, should be prepared with guns and ammunition and food support and water and gold and silver and those kind of things that survivalists say that we should do?
Well, we did all that during the nuclear hoax back in the 50s. We built underground reservoirs of food and water, and none of it was ever touched. They finally took the underground bomb shelters and made card rooms out of them. So I don't see any reason for us to go back down that road again because we were suckered into it once and it turned out to be a hoax. I think the American people have to prepare their minds for what is coming.
That's what I mean.
And that is the new American Revolution. Because it's not only America that has to survive.
That's right.
But civilization has to survive. Because if America doesn't win through this, the world itself has no chance anywhere. Because there's very little civilization left in anywhere in the world today. You mentioned cows were the original currency in Europe. And, of course, cows are still the only currency in the entire continent of Africa.
Yeah.
I mean, your wealth is measured by how many cows you have.
Right.
And that is the state of civilization over most of the world. They simply have not... the American people don't realize that everybody in Europe and Asia and Africa does not have two cars and a summer house in the mountains and so forth.
Well, I'd like to bring to the attention of the American people who are listening in on this program that in 1983, I had a confrontation with a Jew from Manhattan, and his name was Jerry. That's all I'll give you at this point. And I asked him, I said, Jerry, I know about the Jewish conspiracy. I've studied it in some length. And you know, the first thing he said to me was, Richard, how did you know? How did you find out? So I answered that question. And then I asked him, I said, Jerry, what's going to be the bottom line? What is going to be the ultimate effect of the end when this thing is finally solved? And he looked at me and he says, Richard, I don't really want to talk about it. But I will tell you this. It is going to end in the greatest catastrophic bloody revolution in the history of humanity. And I could tell from the look on this guy's face, he had been found out. He didn't deny it. He knew it was coming. And he didn't really know which way it was going to go, but it was going to be the greatest catastrophic bloody revolution in the history of humanity. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't see it in those terms, because I don't see that it will be a world catastrophe, because it's going to... the battleground is right here in the United States.
That's right.
If we can win the battle here, we've got the rest of the world. And you can see that American troops are going all over the world right now and attacking every country. So it's got to control the situation. It has to come from this country because there's no one else there available to come in and straighten things out.
Well, I hope you don't get the idea that I suckered you into that question and that answer, but I did. I wanted you to say exactly what you just said from your heart.
My goodness. Well, it came from the heart.
That's right.
I would say the same thing to anybody, because if we've got some tough days coming ahead, and I've had some tough days already. I'm in my 80s now, and so I'm not going to be fighting for the next 50 years, I don't think.
Right.
But there are people who are going to have to resolve this situation, and they're going to have to do it through their own efforts and their own diligence and their own dedication.
Well, the reason why I got us into that mode to answer that question was simply for this, that the American people are so entertained. They're giving phony money so they can buy the boob tube and drink the beer and have their sex and continue with their entertainment and go to the beach and go to Disneyland and have a good time, that they are distracted from those very, very vital and important aspects of what's going on in the world, and they, as Americans here in this country, are key elements to save not only their country, their children, their wives, their families, but what happens here also affects what happens in the rest of the world. So it's very, very important that Americans wake up, get with the program, and start looking in a positive direction. Would you agree?
Well, they've got to do it, and I've been doing it all my life.
That's right.
And Disneyland is not reality, and it's never going to be reality, so don't... the fact that they have managed to perpetrate these atrocities, really, on the human mind is bad enough, but I think that our minds can recover from it.
Well, when we look at the movies today, the trash and the filth,
well, people really don't go to the movies anymore, I don't think. I haven't been near a movie in 25 years.
Well, if you listen to the control media, you'd think that everybody was flocking down to these new productions and the new types of movies that are being portrayed. But they're just taking fantasy and pumping it into your living room through the television, through the sitcoms, and keeping you pacified, complacent, and just trying to tread water while they're undermining our country, and things don't look very happy. But if America understands what's going on, they can help prevent a tremendous amount of death, disease, and poverty by doing something positive.
Oh, yes.
Well, you got
to be positive, and I think it will happen. I think people rise to the occasion. And when they realize that they've got to settle down and get to work, they'll do it.
Well, Eustace, we're coming to the conclusion of our second hour. I want to give you the opportunity of finishing this up. Is there any important truths and wisdom of knowledge that you've accumulated that you would like to pass on to our people?
Well, I have never lost faith that this nation would endure. And the fact that this was a noble experiment, which was announced in 1775, and of course it was infiltrated and betrayed from where the word go. As I told you about 1787 Constitutional Convention by the Masons, is one of the greatest betrayals of the entire American system, and it's been going on ever since. But that can be corrected, and that can be corrected in a very short time.
So you wouldn't say that all the Masons are bad guys, just a few of them that took advantage of, like Adam Weishaupt and the Illuminati, how they infiltrated the Masons, right?
Oh, yes. Well, George Washington himself said that the Illuminati were infiltrating the Masons and destroying Masonry, and I think he was absolutely right. But the fact is that people can poison something, but you can still use it. And most of the Masons are the Blue Lodge members who don't know anything about what's going on. And if you tell them that the Masons are bad people, they'd be outraged. Because
sure.
They know all the Masons. They're all pretty good people.
Sure, sure.
And but the Blue Lodges, as Albert Pike said, he instructed in his Morals and Dogma, he instructed the Masons that you must never tell the members of the Blue Lodges anything about what we're doing.
Yeah.
And it was under penalty of death. They were never to inform the Blue Lodge's members as to what was going on.
So
that's the way they've operated ever since.
So certain aspects of the Freemasons did take on a guise of secret societies in and of themselves. Yeah.
A lot of mumbo-jumbo and so forth. Well, in fact, the Ku Klux Klan was a rerun of the Masonic societies because they used the same terms, the Grand Kleagle and so forth. The whole Ku Klux Klan was a Mason operation.
Yes, yes. Well, I think we've done it for the night. We've almost gone through 2 hours of intensive talk about money.
We have laid the groundwork.
Yes.
And this is something we can build something on. Now, I could not give you tonight, on such short notice, a complete program of operations for the next 25 years. But we'll get there. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you've laid the groundwork, especially with all the enormous amounts of written material in your books that you've provided, and that's a great benefit for all of us conspiratologists around the world.
Well, you know, when I met Ezra Pound in the insane asylum, he had spent 30 years in Europe studying the international conspiratorial aspects that were going on. And he studied in 8 languages. So he really had a tremendous groundwork. And see, that was all turned over to me, a 25-year-old who knew nothing about anything. And this great accumulation of wisdom was just turned over to me lock, stock, and barrel. And I have been using it ever since. And anybody else can do the same thing. Because once you know this information, you can never be dissuaded from this job.
Well, you can never be the same person again.
Oh, you never can be. Yeah, my mother said to me one time, she said, Ezra Pound destroyed your life. And I said, Ezra Pound didn't destroy my life, he created it.
That's right, that's right. He gave you a purpose in life, didn't he?
Oh, yes, because I didn't know anything about anything. And can you imagine, in the last 50 years, if I couldn't have given this information to the American people, what a disaster that would have been.
What a wasted life you would have had.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
well, like everybody else in his life.
Yeah, well, just like I said in the introduction, the aspects of how Jews use money to destroy their enemies and collapse civilizations is facts that they don't want anybody to know about.
Exactly. And they stick to it. And that's why they had me fired from the Library of Congress, because they could not have any employee of the Library of Congress knowing what was going on.
Yeah.
And they haven't had a single person there since they fired me in 1952.
Yeah. Well, America is going to face a lot of hardships and a lot of trial and bloody confrontations into the near future, is my belief. But I want to say thank you, Eustace Mullins, for being on our program. I sincerely appreciate your tremendous amount of labor, time, and research and writings, and the contribution that you've given to mankind. You are truly an American son and a hero to our people. And thank you very much. We're going to have to call it quits tonight, but I appreciate you being here, and maybe you can be on First Step in the future.
Well, I think we have made a great step forward, and this is something we can build on.
Right. Well, thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being with us on First Step at Conspiratology.com. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this was our First Step program for February 8th, 2006.